you can design, you know, something that can work for both parties. But look, at the end of the day, it's all about trust to begin with. You know, It doesn't matter what economy is gonna you're gonna be sharing between two of you or three of you. You know, it's just in the future, right? It's now. It's how to make things work between you and your partner, because you're gonna partner with them for the next 10 years. You're basically married for the next 10 years, right? And what do you have? All we have is trust.
Hold that thought. Teams everywhere are dealing with a serious problem, a productivity problem. But don't worry, HubSpot's customer platform can help. No more time-consuming tasks, no more chasing down prospect info, no more one system for this, another for that. HubSpot helps you find leads, reach prospects, and deliver the insights to convert them into customers all in one place, making your productivity problem no problem at all. Visit HubSpot.com to learn how they can help you grow better. Welcome to Billion Dollar Moves, the show for the top founders, funders, and execs making billion dollar moves that are shaping our future. From the growing pains of a unicorn journey to IPO, the question of impact, purpose, and returns, we go real deep in the world of venture and business. I'm your host, Sarah Chen Spellings. Before we hop in here, I have a quick favor to ask you. Smash that follow button wherever you're tuning in from. This way, you'd be the first to know of new episodes that drop. And of course, please tell your friends so we can amplify more stories built on grit and the US and Asia venture ecosystem, and that we can all keep making billion dollar moves together. Now let's get started. Today, I have a good friend with me, a fellow Malaysian who has been making some billion dollar moves in making Malaysia and the startup scene what it is today. I'm so excited to bring on my friend, JB, as he's known, Jamaluddin Bujang. JB, how are you?
Good, thank you. How's it going with you over there in DC, I guess? Yeah.
Yes, things are good. I am starting my day with a conversation with you, so I am in a good space. I'm in a good space. Always love talking to you. So JB, really want to get going here with, you know, the first order of business as usual in Billion Dollar Moves, which is to really understand your personal journey. You started Malaysian boy, decided to become a sell-side analyst, work with investment banks for a while, and then eventually, you know, led MathCap and sort of built the VC space to what it is today in a significant way. Many may not know that. So talk to us a little bit, you know, was this always a childhood dream to be in finance, and was VC something that you knew back then?
Where do I start? Okay, maybe I just start from when I was small. I come from a family of, there are five of us, five brothers and sisters. I was born in Singapore. Four of us was born in Singapore, and my youngest brother was born here in Malacca when my father moved from Singapore to Malaysia back in 1971. And then went to study to the US in Kansas, of all places.
Yeah.
Have you been to Kansas yourself? You sure?
Not yet. Yeah.
Not yet. You sure? Yeah. So I went to Kansas to study actually aeronautical engineering to start with. So I started off with that, but after a while, I found out that I'm not very much inclined to engineering and technical stuff. So halfway through, I switched my course to study business, and I learned so much. And I don't have a background at all in doing business, accounting, economics, from there. But I did quite well, because I think I enjoyed it so much. I enjoyed the class. I liked the theories and all that. So finally, I went through. So graduated in 1988 from the US, came back to Malaysia in 1988, and started working since then, 89. Mm-hmm. You know, you asked about whether this all planned or not. Actually, it wasn't planned at all. As a young graduate with economics degree, with bit of knowledge in banking and finance, and I thought, well, yeah, I want to work in a bank. And banking was hot back then, right? And I didn't really get to work in a bank, actually, after applying so many times. And about 1 year after that, I saw this advertisement looking for analysts in a stockbroking company. So right. I said, okay, let's give it a try. I never thought of doing analysts. I probably had some background studying finance and all that in school, but let's try being analyst. I applied, and they took me, and I did quite well. I really enjoyed the job, really. I really enjoyed being analyst, financial analyst. And in fact, I was doing my job as an analyst lasted for easily like 15 years.
Wow.
You know, yeah. You know, I've, of course, I worked from one place to another, but still doing analyst work. So that's how we started off from, you know, from school and now become an analyst. And then a bit of background on the, you know, how I started off in healthcare. I was with an investment bank until 2005. And my ex-colleague, joined a VC company, which is a subsidiary of Khazanah. And after he joined, he wants to take new people in. And then one day he just called him, hey, so look, both of us have been around investment bank for so long. Why don't, you know, I've been a plunge and why don't you do the same thing? Join me and, you know, help me, you know, do this stuff. And I said, okay, good. It's about time as well. I think after doing the same job for 15 years, interesting, no doubt. I said, yeah, let's take a plunge and, you know, join him to work in a VC setup. So I joined him. I'm looking after the corporate services, they call it, you know, right. That looking after the, you know, legal, finance, sectorial, whatever, which is non-investment at all. And the reason I want to do that is not because I don't like to do investment, but that's because, you know, in the past, I've had enough experience in investment, I thought. So I think this is probably time to do something else, right? So it's good. So I was doing that for 3 years. And then the CEO changed and the new CEO came in and said, hey, look, I'm looking for someone to head the investment department rather than taking someone new. Right. Since I know you and you have the background from inside, why don't you just take over? So I moved to doing investment again in that company. It's called MTDC. So I was doing finance for 3 years. And at the end of 2011, MathCap, I got a call from my friend in MathCap. And they say, hey, you know, MathCap looking for a CEO. We don't have a CEO for the last, like, 6 or 7 months. And they're still looking. And they call me, do you know anyone who wants to apply for a job? I said, why don't you apply? I said, I never thought I wanted to become a CEO. And never crossed my mind because, you know, I thought, I just want to be head of division. That's it. You know, being CEO is not easy. I know that. And I say, look. You just, update your resume. Just give it to me. You know, after all, they're looking for at least three applications, right? I say, okay. I'll find a favor. I'll do it to you. And then not long after that, the board called me up and said, hey, you know, we have a vacancy here. We want to consider you to come in as a CEO. And we said, you know, we also interviewing other people. We'll debate. I think they think about 2-3 months to decide for me to appoint me as a CEO in MathCap. I'm quite familiar with MathCap at that time, their role, what they do and all that, because I come from the same line, right? And when they offered me a job as a CEO, I said, I was thinking twice because I want to stay on at MTDC because I want to do something else. I want to stay on with that company doing new things. I guess fate will have it. I said, okay, let's just take a plunge anyway. Let's try it again for the second time, right? So I did it.
Jamal, if I may pause you a second, a couple of things, you know, as you're telling this story. First of all, when you went into corporate services because you wanted to do something different, you know, some people would view that as, oh, you know, it's corporate services. It's a support role. It's not that glamorous compared to investing. And you've been in investing for 15 years. Was there not that sense of ego that you had to reshift? You know, how did you think about that? Was it sort of you wanted to know the nuts and bolts? What was the thinking there for you to first make that step?
Yeah, good question. Actually, I asked that myself. But I think, you know, I can't think of doing investment. And I was asking myself, do you really want to do the investment until the end of until you retire? Why don't you try something new as well? And I thought it's a good idea as well, also because you never know the next time and next stage of your growth. You know, you want to make yourself more well-rounded, right? As you climb the corporate ladder, right? Which I think that was a good decision. So now when I become a CEO of MathCap, I know how finance do their work, the problems that's faced by the corporate services, by the corporate comm, by, you know, all other departments which I used to look after, right? So it really helped me. It really helped me when I became a CEO of MathCap.
Interesting. And then, you know, going back to your MathCap story, you said, I never imagined myself as a CEO. Where does that come from? The fact that you never identified yourself in that leadership position?
No, it's I'm very well aware of, you know, the problems a CEO face. You know, I've been like in that company as a number two. Now, of course, there are a few other number twos as well. I'm just one of the number twos there, right? And you can imagine, I can see, I observe, you know, I love to help the CEO doing his job, executing his orders and executing departmental objectives and all that. But being CEO, yeah, it's a totally different game altogether. You are dealing with the shareholders, the board, and in this case, the government officials as well, and so many things. You're not, you know, when I look at that, I said, since I left his job, I as well do this thing rather than dealing with other things which got nothing to do with, you know, real work, you know what I'm saying? So that's how I see it. So that's reason why I don't want to become a CEO actually to begin with. But you know, as you move one stage to another, there's always a challenge, someone poking you from behind and say, hey, you know, try something new. Try it. Just you never know, you know. So yeah, that's what I did.
So what did you learn from your chapter in MathCap? I mean, you clearly were doing a good job if you were renewed for a few times. And wanna also hear, you know, particularly from the LP perspective, right? Now you decided, okay, let's work with funds, and you actually created co-GP models, i.e. you worked with fund managers as, you know, an equal, depending on the share, entity to help run those funds as well and be in. For some, you're a quiet investor, so limited partner investor. For some, you took a more active role. Talk to us a little bit about what you learned in that chapter as an LP in building funds in a nascent market.
The funny thing about working for a GLC is, you know, the CEO has, they give you only two-year term.
And right, so a government-linked company,
You know, they renew you every 2 years. And that can be negative, you know, if you really think about it. You know, there's no CEO wants to work for 2 years, right? That's because of lack of, but thank God they renewed, I think, in my case, 3 times. So I lasted about 7 years in MathCap. If I was the longest, you know, compared to the previous 3 CEOs. Again, thank you for that, because we managed to execute things that we wanted to do. Now, on the partnership and all that with LPs, okay, MathCap is also not only we do direct investment back then, we also an LP, also having partnership with all these VCs, right? You know, MathCap, if you look at it carefully, it is, our role should be an LP to begin with. Our job is actually to grow the industry. We create more VCs, invite them to come over to Malaysia if they haven't come yet. And in so doing, there will be more capital available for the Malaysian market. Because no other VCs will do that, right? Whether you're private or government. That's what we should do. I think we've done well in that sense. Now, when we go out and try to work with other VCs, well, you know, there are a few of them, 500, the finest startups, one of them, of course, Gobi and the Alexa Capital and all that. And we expect them to raise money from outside of Malaysia. And like Gobi, for example, they raise money from other sources, from China, you know, and Alexa Capital, they raise from the US. And 500 also raised from US as well as from Malaysia as well. And those money that they raise from Malaysia are the money that we won't be able to raise it ourselves, even though we're in Malaysia, right? So again, so it's good. I think it complements MathCap strategy, and we give a lot of freedom to the VCs to manage their own ways of doing business, so long as they comply with certain guidelines, so long as it falls within certain expectation from MathCap. You know, it's like certain percentage of investments must be Malaysian companies. You can invest the rest outside Malaysia, because, you know, technology is borderless, right? Good companies can start from any, you know, any country, and they can just come here and become number one. So you want to invest that company rather than investing in someone doing the same thing, but it's based here, but it's not good enough to compete, right?
Yeah. So if I may dive a little bit deeper here, you know, you've played quite a significant role in building some of these funds, right? To set up, to understand the market, you know, beyond just capital. I think sometimes you don't give yourself enough credit, but it you know, you help to facilitate a lot of these funds in the early days when, frankly, people didn't even know what there was no template to follow, right? In building like Axiata, Gobi, so on and so forth, to actually decide, even Gobi, which is 1.2 billion, and now you're with them, and we'll shift to that a little bit. But they still have a strong headquarters in Malaysia and are investing into Malaysia years later. So talk to us a little bit about your role as an LP. Okay. What have you learned in observing these funds? Like, what were the early mistakes they made? What were the good stuff that they discovered to be able to grow to this stage?
You know, it's funny, you know, you are local, you are someone here already in this environment, and you've been there for years and years. Sometimes you don't see things the way other people look at things, you know. And this is where all this managers have the advantage over us, right? I mean, Gobi before that has done investments in China. They have gone through since 2002, making investments in China, investing exactly the same company that they had in China then here. So they already get that learnings, which they can only import and apply. And, you know, they can sort of expect the sort of problems that may arise because that's what happened in China. The same thing with other funds as well. 500 is very good at this. 500 has invested by the time I left, I think they have done about, more than 1,000 investments. More than 1,000 investments already by the time. So imagine all the data or information that they have on founders, on companies, on sectors, whole lot of things which they have. And then you can apply on the Malaysian market, right? So they have a better idea. They have advantage of local managers in picking up companies. So we learn a lot. There's a lot of things that MFCAP learned from these people. And in fact, that one of the things that we want to make sure that all this transfer of technology and knowledge coming to MFCAP is, you know, we want them to, we do secondment of staff into some of these companies. You know, we still have secondment staff in Gobi from MFCAP. And sometimes we participate in the IC as non-voting members. We do that. Some voting, some fund is non-voting. So we learn a lot. And we refer deals to them and we go and bring the deals together with them. We discuss. And they need MFCAP's expertise as well because they want to know, have you met this guy before? What do you think? You know, so we can do that, which they don't, right? And so that's, and you know, having MFCAP as part of the LP, right, it gives them an advantage as well because now, and the list of LPs in that fund, there's one Malaysian government entity as an LP. So it gives a lot of, you know, comfort to other LPs when they put money into the fund. So it's actually very symbiotic relationship. It benefits MFCAP as well as, you know, to the managers. You know, this is a case where 1+1 = 3 or more. Right? It's not 1+1. So it works. It's been working. So I don't see reason why it shouldn't work at other places as well.
Yeah, and I want to, you know, this angle is interesting because, you know, we're working a lot with LPs right now as well. And there's a whole group of emerging managers, right? New GPs that are coming into play and not many would have the benefit of nascent markets as well. You know, the I'm looking at some saturated, I guess, developed markets now where we may not have, you know, the similar government support as Malaysia, Singapore, many other Southeast Asia countries had, right? So what... For the managers that are listening in, new managers, what would you say are the top three qualities that you've seen over the years that you've been in business as an LP, picking funds, working with funds that really stands them out for success?
The managers, first of all, you need the experience, right? I mean, I'm just trying to relate what Gobi and 500 has gone through. They, in their own little ecosystem, they have learned a lot. They've gone through all, they've made mistakes. And these are sometimes not small mistakes. Like Gobi, for example, they have been sued a few times. And we've won all those. You won all cases, according to Tom, back in China. So we learn. You must be able to learn. And that is the asset that you have that if you want to work with potential LPs. And as LPs want to view you as someone who has the experience and you have gone through all that, you understand your certain, you know, the expertise that you are good at, you know, a certain vertical. They say you are a GP with strength in e-commerce, for example, you know, then you should become a master in e-commerce. If you're in AI, you must be very focused and really understand in AI. Same thing. So LPs can, because they choose many GPs, right? And they will want to pick, they don't want a generalist because they have so many choices of generalists out there, right? And if I'm an LP, I want to choose 10 funds, I want to give one allocation for AI, one allocation for logistics, one allocation for future commerce, so many other things, right? Rather than give it to 10 generalists. So if you're a GP, that you should build expertise within your you're very familiar with.
You know, there's always a question of, is that attributable track record, first of all? And number two is also, you know, the fact that some of them may not have had the opportunity, but it doesn't mean that they won't make good fund managers. You know, they just never grew up in a position of privilege where they were able to go to the best schools to then have a friend call them up and say, hey, do you want to be part of the VC? So what do you say to that when it's a situation where you want to give an intern an internship, but you're asking for the job experience first, right? So how do you think about that? And what's your advice to new managers who may not be the cookie cutter candidate?
I think this is a role where you as an LP you have to adopt it, right? I agree with you. You know, not the familiar GP with, they're already familiar with, and you want to give them money all the time. You want to develop an ecosystem, right? You should give the opportunity for people who have probably thinner, but you do your duty. You find out that this guy has certain traits which, you know, which he can execute. And has been proven to execute it when he was in previous company. So yeah, I agree with you. If you're an LP, right, out of 100% I want to give out, maybe you can give 70% or 60% to the normal guys with strong track record and all that. And the balance 30 or 40% you should give to new guys, because these guys eventually will become good and they will replace those guys.
So now we go into your Gobi chapter. You spent a couple of years, you know, renewed your term for a couple of times. So it was a total of 7 years in MAFCAP, right, I believe? So 15 years in as an analyst, banking, and then went on into working for the government in venture and spurring all these things. And then you joined one of the GPs, the general partners, the fund managers that you actually supported in a private enterprise. So my question to you is, how was that shift of mindset to work from a government hat, semi-quasi-government, right? You still work with outsiders, but very much driven by the government. But then now sort of working with Tom, working with you know, guys in the private sector that are go.
Yeah, I mean, after MAFCAP, obviously, if you want to, for me, is going back to the private sector after I left. I come from private sector also to begin with, right? I think, okay, in Gobi's case, it's quite interesting. It wasn't like totally planned. But the thing is, when I left MAFCAP, and about the same time, Gobi was already considering to invest. I haven't joined Gobi at that time. But I've already, you know Tom. He's just one floor up in our building, just one floor up. So we meet every day anyway. When I was MAFCAP. you know, we talk about deals, we talk market and all that. And then one day he said, look, we have this investment in Pakistan we want to invest in. And then he said, maybe you should, you know, why don't you talk to these guys? I haven't joined MAFCAP, Gobi at the time. So happened in that year, in 2018, end of 2018, Pakistan, I think the industry there arranged like a big event for the IT, for digital stuff. It's called O2O. It was O2O or something like that. And since Gobi wanted to invest in one company there, and they said, hey, you know, there's one event, industry event. Why don't we just go to Karachi? Have you gone to Karachi? I said, no, none of us has gone to Karachi before. Why don't we just go and, you know, maybe we get a better feel or about Pakistan, about what's going on. And, you know, if you read what Pakistan, if you have been to Pakistan, what you read in the news is, it's not really that good, right? Right? Yeah. So we went and we were totally surprised. You know, we were, you know, there hardly any VC, foreign VC. There are only a few local VCs there when we came. And we met that potential company that we invested in. Also, I said, we like this company and all that. But just before we left, when we got there, I bumped into my coursemate, and I met him. Ali's called Ali from Fatima Group. I was with Ali attending a Stanford program for 2 weeks, organized by 500. So we know each other. So I said, hey, oh yeah, now I know Ali is Pakistani. Are you here? Yeah, I said, what are you doing here? And then he said, I'm doing investment, but you know, I'm using my own money, corporate money, and to invest. I want to do bigger things. I said, hey, you know, why don't we work together? We want to invest in the company also here. But then again, why don't we work together and set up a fund? Right? I said, yeah, okay, that's good. So a few months after that, he came back. He came to KL and said, we really explored it and said, hey, I think there's a good chance for us if you want to set up a fund in Pakistan, and he can help us raise money from Pakistan. And we went to Pakistan a few regularly after then, raising money, and we managed to get a fund done. So that's how it started. And I joined Gobi after that in April, in May of 2019.
Got it. So talk to us a little bit about what does it take for you as a new GP, right? A new partner that, you know, you've known Tom for a while, you've got that relationship. Right. partnership and then to start a new partnership, because partnerships, as you know, in startups, I think we talked about this, the number one reason startups fail is, okay, lack of money, you know, no fit, you know, there's no market, but also a big chunk of it is partnerships breaking down.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about fund management and working together for a fund, which is at least the life cycle of fund 5 to 10 years, how do you think about that? How do you think about working with someone that actually you only met through a course, but you know, it wasn't like your lifetime friend? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the shortest answer to that is chemistry. And of course, there's other elements that, that help as well. Ali is, to begin with, he's young. He's less than 30 years old. You know, and he's eager. He comes from a family who has done all this. All his brothers are looking after certain things in Fatma Group. And then he's trying to carve himself out. I want to focus on doing investments. In fact, yeah, very small investment. And but he doesn't have a big brother to help him, you know.
Got it.
And here we come. And then because the chemistry works so well with between him and us, that's like that's a complete trust, you know, between him and us. And for that, I'm thankful to God. I think we found a good partner. He treats us as it's equal partner, really. You know, whatever economics that we get from this fund, we split equally. You know, that's how we started off. I think he's very happy with that, and he knows that we trust him as well. And we have people like Tom, who's you can easily mix with, and Tom works well with him as well. So, and I got Tariq is you know, my colleague. He clicks very well with Ali as well. He is he comes from Pakistan descent as well. So you know, the chemistry is all there. So you know, I think we're just lucky. You know, to have a partnership that has a lot of common ingredients to help support that partnership. We're just lucky.
Hey, we're taking a quick break here so I can tell you about this new show that just joined our network. Created, hosted by John Yushai, is brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. Created gives an insight look at how to build a business as a creator, improve your creative process, and stay ahead of the latest content trends. John Yushai, ex-YouTube and Instagram employee, breaks down the creator economy with guests like Logan Paul, Paris Hilton, Jason Derulo, Jake Paul, George Lopez, and so much more. A not-so-recent episode I loved was actually the one with Liza Koshy. Remember her? She was one of the fastest-growing YouTubers and Viners, if you remember that, growing a fan base well beyond 25 million subscribers. But then she stopped uploading. What happened to Liza Koshy? That's a smart woman who made a drastic career decision, what I may call a billion-dollar move. You'd want to tune in to this one. Listen to Created wherever you get your podcasts.
So Jamal, you are always so modest. You know, sure, there's an element of luck, but I personally believe you set yourself up to be lucky, right? Like there's a lot of things that you've done. The fact that you went to Pakistan and made an effort and also went to Stanford and all, you sort of set yourself up for luck in a certain way. So I want to hear from you, you know, as you, hindsight's 2020, as you look at that partnership with Fatima, you know, what was, how did you build that up for success? Was there a clear discussion from day one? You know, because a lot of fund managers actually tune into this and we want to know, you know, when we work with partners, co-founders, how do you think about this? How do we think about building a fund up for success? Is it one that does, you know, on the ground because he's there and you support the franchise through other resources? How do you think about that split?
I think you can design, you know, something that can work for both parties. But look, at the end of the day, it's all about trust to begin with, you know. It doesn't matter what economy is gonna you're gonna be sharing between two of you or three of you. You know, it's just in the future, right? It's now. It's how to make things work between you and your partner, because you're gonna partner with them for the next 10 years. You're basically married for the next 10 years, right? What do you have? All you have is trust. That's it, you know. And he should be doing something that you want to do, but he has also expect you to do something that he wants as well, right? So there must be constant what you call it, engagement between the two parties, you know. This, like I said, I think chemistry plays a big role in it. You don't want to have a relationship that's guided by just black and white agreement. You know, you can do this. You know, no agreement can cover all this requirement that you want and match with what he wants. Seriously, you know, again, so, you know, you really have to, you know, sometimes you have to trust your luck. I think, as you know, you say that I'm modest, but I think I, you know, I believe that, you know, someone up there has planned things for some. I'm sure it planned for everyone, right? Yeah, just that, you know, you need and try to make it happen. One interesting thing, though, talking about luck, I wouldn't say luck is a word, but like I said, I think it's been designed. You know, how are you went to Stanford and met Ali and now we are? Actually, there's the story behind it as well. You know, when I was in MathCap, right?
Yeah.
And this is even before I joined MathCap. No, I told you earlier that MathCap has two programs for this. They funded local GPs, right? And one of the GPs is called Peak Capital, right? And this is even before I joined, right? And Peak Capital, among the companies that invested, is a company that Kylie set up, right? And Kylie was young. Yeah. Kylie set up that, and he got invested by Peak. And by the time I joined, Peak has just, I think they already exited Kylie's company. And Kylie was, after exiting, of course, he has some money and time and all that to do things that he wants to do. And he got hooked to 500 ecosystem. And he did very well. In fact, not long after that, he became a partner, right, of 500 founder startup. And because it's from Malaysia, and Dave said, hey, look, you know, Malaysia is a good market. Why don't you go and set up a fund and go and raise money from there? And I first met Kylie after I joined. That was in 2012, I think. It was sitting next to me. You know Kylie, right? He's bubbly and all that. And I was, I just joined a totally new with it. Wow, this guy, like, man, this guy is so charged. Nice to have him, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then not long after that, he came to my office and said, hey, you know, I met you last time. I want to come see you. And, you know, I got this fund and I want to set up. And so I said, I come to our office. And they said, okay, I want to set up a fund. Have we got some people committed to this fund? And then I said, why don't MathCap put money into this? So, and I kind of like the idea. We don't put a lot of money into his fund anyway. But we are one of the biggest seeders for that fund called Durian One. That's how it started. And he managed to set up a fund. And then we continued to invest in other funds, Durian 2 and other things. And he's done well. Now, and then when that Stanford thing came, that was a 500 startups program. And they said, hey, look, why don't you get all people participate? And the Kylie said, hey, get JB to come and participate. I was quite hesitant to begin with because I have to be in the US for 2 weeks, going back to study. Going 2 weeks is okay, but going back, you know, in the classroom and study.
Yeah.
Right. And like I said, look, you meet a lot of people, you know, these are interesting people and all that. So, okay, then I go. And that's why I meet Ali. And, you know, now, and the rest is, of course, history. You know, just talking about the power of chance and, I don't know, luck, I don't know what. This being designed by someone above. You know, that thing plays a role as well.
Of course. So now going into, I don't know where to go from there, but really you want to hear, you know, so let's talk about... This is powerful. No, this is very important. Let's talk about Malaysia. So you helped Kylie, right? Mm-hmm. Since we're on that topic, when it was very nascent, and I saw you made a you presented recently about just the state of Malaysia. What something like 80 million invested last year. You know, Southeast Asia is on the rise now, so Malaysia has certainly benefited from that as well. How have you seen the landscape evolve over the years? You know, with startups that are growing, what are we seeing here in Malaysia, and what can we be excited by?
You know, I think when you look at Malaysia, I think we should look at Southeast Asia as a bigger market, right? We're talking about Southeast Asia here, right? 600 million people. I mean, everyone knows that. There's about 10% of the world's population. You know, we have rising middle class. You know, you're one of them. I'm one of them. You know, and over the years, we've seen things has improved a lot within these ASEAN countries. Malaysia, definitely. You know, poverty rate has dropped a lot. Consumer market is big. You know, highly literate and stuff like that. So all these ingredients has been around for quite a while since, in Malaysia's case, since this started to go up since the 70s, right? Now, Malaysia alone, if you think about it, the best thing about Malaysia is, you know, we have a very pro-business policy from day one, right? And then we have a VC, helping the private sector, small, medium-scale industries for the longest time, as you can recall, right? And this is where VC came in. VC came to Malaysia back in the mid-80s. I was still studying at that time. There's one of few guys. There are a few guys who set up a VC fund. Private sector is not launched by the government. But by early 1990, the government already started thinking of, let's set up a VC industry. And that's when NTDC came into the picture. You know, NTDC started off in the early 90s, and they're still around. And after MathCap in 2001, they pour money into all these companies, and we can see the product, we can see the companies, we can see a lot of new startups that coming from all that program, right? So it is a best place. I think a lot of people from outside, if you're coming into Malaysia, right, they see Malaysia as the best test bed for testing products because, hey, we have, you know, we are multiracial, multireligious, politically very stable, test our product and services, and it's a gateway to Indonesia, which is a big market, right? Again, we have all that ingredients. Yeah.
So a few things. Are we politically stable now?
You know, I think we have no choice. Eventually, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, when there's a vacuum, that you get filled in so fast after that, right? Things will correct itself in one way or another, right?
Okay.
And if you want to give a probability whether it's going to change for the better or for the worse, I think people here are smart enough to know that let's change for the better, right? We are not, I think politically, if you talk about politically, right, we are not in, like in some of the countries, we have a very strong police, I don't know what that's word, military driven, you know, influences and all that. We are pretty civil when it comes, right? Yeah, I think it'll correct itself. There's a lot of smart people, the young generation, they are smart, of course, they need to be guided, definitely. Yeah, but we have seen success cases everywhere. Of course, now at this point in time, we are somewhere in between, hey, let's do this. Everyone is aware now there's a lot of political interest to be served before, you know, I'm still confident, you know, we'll be for the better, seriously.
So you're an optimist for sure. You've ridden this wave, different waves throughout the years. So I see that. But what would you say to external parties? Right, you work with, your role in MAFCAP was to bring external capital as they're looking in, as you know, you said earlier in the conversation, when you're in it, you don't see it. But for people looking in from the outside, it does cause us to pause a little bit, you know, in terms of, is this really a time to further invest into Malaysia at this time? What do you say to that?
Yeah, so, you know, I think for people, for investors outside coming in, right, I'm sure you and I, we have gone through this as well. The things that you read about about the country or news from that country, if you're from the outside, actually, if you don't go to that place, it's actually different when you get there. You know, exactly my experience with Pakistan, you know, before... You know, Tom, his wife was asking when the first time I go there back in 2018. His wife asked me, you really want to go there and Pakistan don't have a good relationship with Chinese people, right? you know, really. And, his wife told me, we better not go. Let those guys go, right? No, but no, when we're on the ground, it's totally different. You know, the same thing. It's the same thing here in Malaysia. So anyone can say anything and say, report things which is not as balanced as we wanted. But, you know, until you come here and look and feel, you don't have the full picture of what the country is, you know, is what it is, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
I definitely agree that you have to, you know, boots on the ground to really see it for what it is, right? And independence of media is something that's so important that unfortunately today we struggle with a lot. So then to your pro-business point, I had Aerodyne, as you know, Kamaro and Azita were kind enough to spend time and shared some really powerful insights. But what they actually shared, one of the things they said was in the beginning, they had to, it was a little bit rough for them in Malaysia and they said they had to go outside, work in Australia, get these contracts that prove their validity and credibility to then come back into Malaysia. What do you say to that if you say we're pro-business?
It happens all the time. You know, it's not just their case. There are many other cases where a company comes with a product and they try to sell it to government. We invested in some of those companies and we've gone through that. It is, I think there's a lot of, you know, people who make decisions at the corporate or at the GLC level, they are not into... They're not so much on the ground, number one, I think. Number two is because I think they're not brave enough to make this, to take risk, right? You know, you can evaluate the product. Of course, they can be less, you know, less features, less stuff, and of course, cheaper, right? Compared to imported products. Imported products has a strike record, a lot of things that come with it. But, you know, but local product could be just as good, right?
Exactly.
They just didn't have the time frame to prove it to you that they will do well. But I think a lot of people who make that decision not to buy local products is simply because they are not brave enough, to test. You know, they don't want to make mistakes. You know, the problem about top management here is like, you know, if a CEO makes a mistake, you know, he could lose his job. I told you my contract is 2 years renewable, right? And I cannot afford to make one mistake and next contract I'm up, you know? Again, the CEOs are not given enough, what do you call it, confidence for him to even take higher risk. So because of that, a lot of companies will come to play safe, CEO, even board level as well, for that matter. They're not willing to make mistakes. They just go with the flow. They just go with what has been proven in the past and repeat that again. Why try something new? Let other people try something new. you, right?
Oh, Jamal, I so appreciate you saying that. And, you know, my question then is, what's actionable about this, right? How do we change? Because this is the problem of large corporates, right? Let's not just say it's a Malaysia problem. Sure, it is a Malaysia problem, but it is corporates, right? Because your incentives as a senior executive may not necessarily, well, in a lot of companies, it means things are changing now, but it may not be tied to you taking risk. You're in fact incentivized to maintain status quo. And I reflect on some of my experiences in working for a conglomerate where people have been there for so long because they've been just tagging along, you know, they were not dangerous for the company. They were not challenging this and disrupting, but then disruption doesn't happen. So how do we change this? What's your message to senior management that are leading in these sort of companies now?
I've been talking about this even when I was still in MedCap. I think the first thing that they need to do is first the board. You know, you probably have to get a board members who can understand, who's willing to take risks themselves, right? Number one. Number two is, even if you want to play safe, right, you can always create a new unit, which, you know, give a lot of independence that you need to explore new things. And you must understand that you can lose money. You know, but you can always learn from that mistakes all the time. I mean, corporate can afford to do that, right? But unfortunately, some corporate don't take that view. They, you know, failure is a failure. And, you know, I got to protect my job because I cannot make mistake. And, you know, if I want to take, you know, do something new, get other guys to do it. I think that's what happened.
So you have to change the incentive structure. How do you design this to, how do you design to encourage actual innovation from within your company?
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe at the top, like the company or the board can say that, okay, look, this is your, okay, this is your CEO, you want to do this, deliver this, right? But give him a space for him to try something new. He is totally, he should be, spend more time and the right people and the right team to do these new things, right? And then at the board level, your valuation on him is not because of his failure in that new thing that he wants to do, right? He should be valued first on what he has delivered in the beginning. You shouldn't penalize him for making a mistake in this new ventures that he is doing, because otherwise he himself is not gonna take the risk.
Yeah.
Right. So he should be allowed to explore. And you know, think about taking risk is there are two outcomes, right? You can fail, but at the same time you can make it. Right. I don't know why people keep focusing on you will fail because something new and all that, you know, that guy has done it and you know, he lost money. It doesn't mean that it will happen to you, right? If you've got the right people, you got the right strategy, right? Go ahead, do it. Right.
Well, I've pushed you a lot, Jamal, and this has been fantastic. I mean, we went to directions that I didn't even expect, but I love it about luck. And no, but these are the actual learnings that matter, right? People, you know, when you think about it, you need to be conscious about all these little things that add up into your life is a sum of all your experiences. As Steve Jobs says, the dots connect looking back. So just that's exactly what you did.
Exactly.
Right there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I believe in that.
So final segment, billion-dollar questions, 8 quick questions and your quick responses, okay? What is your highest high, JB?
I think the highest high would be setting up the Ajata Fund when I was in MedCap, because we have never done that even before, taking money from the private sector for the first time, and we put our own money and we get a partner to co-manage that fund. That was the first time ever we did as a company in MedCap. And of course, the second one is Pakistan. You know, I told you about the story about meeting Ali, you know, and then, you know, now the Pakistan fund, we managed to probably raise 30 million. So again, those are the two highest points, I would say, from me.
When you think of the word successful, who do you think of and why?
I think Patrick Grove is one of them, definitely. You know, I was in the investment bank last time, right? Back in mid-2000s, our investment banker friends, and they say, I remember Patrick went to see him and to try to raise money and all that. Patrick, that time was really young, you know, a young guy, you know, spunky guy, wants to raise money, want to do big things, digital, right? And my friend was laughing, at him. What is this guy? I'm not going to give him money, you know? I will never believe his business model. Look, 15 years after that, Patrick is what he is now, you know? So I met that guy who told me that, you know, I think we made a mistake for not funding him, you know? So Patrick is one of them. Of course, Tom is another guy. You know, the best thing about Tom is because he, you know, he has best of both worlds, you know, born in the US, work in China, And now he and Sarah, so he can marry the experience and also, you know, looking at Asia from the Western perspective as well, right? Which is good. And I think he's been very successful in doing that. He's been around for 6 years here, and I hope he will continue to be here doing stuff, interesting thing. I think those are two or
so three. So is your definition, that, yeah. I mean, the way you frame it, the definition of success, it's very much tied to business success. Is that your definition of success?
I think the thing that you want to measure is the impact that these people bring. Those, you know, Tom, Patrick, you know, these are just people. But what you want to know is what they have delivered, and that really make a real change. You know, that's the point.
Common misconceptions about JB.
I don't know what is misconception. I didn't check the people.
I'll check with them after this.
I didn't check with people, but I think, you know, me as a person, probably a lot of people see me as a probably less diplomatic or less tech. When I deal with some people, I think that's the, in some cases, I won't say in all cases. Yeah. But I'm not like that. You know, I probably not good at, you know, going around and explain things. I don't want to waste my time delivering the point. So I just tell him straight, you know, that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what I think people think. But
all right. Most important or hardest lesson that you've had to learn as a leader?
You know, as a leader in the corporate and all that, right? Especially here in this country or in this culture, right? When the boss says something, your underlings will take it as it is, right? But at the same time, you must understand the bosses also want to hear from people around him, from your subordinate, right? And that is actually not always the case. So as a boss, you must be able to listen and encourage people to give input, and you must be able to listen to them well, and don't just, you know, don't take that suggestion as, you know, it's more, it's not going to work and all that. Maybe there's some points in it that you have to consider. So I think as a boss or as a, you know, as a people hired, you must be able to really listen and, you know, process and evaluate, you know, from your people under you. Yeah.
Favorite tool or hack for productivity?
I like exercising. I do cycle a lot. I try to cycle a lot if I can. As much as I can, actually, especially.
I don't know what you're talking about. You're like a cyclist. You are a cyclist. That's your full-time job. You're just a part-time VC.
I wish I can do more than that. Seriously.
And that keeps you fresh. You feel like it keeps you productive.
Oh, yeah. You know, the best thing about it is that, you know, when you're on a bicycle, right, on a saddle, and you have that 45 minutes on 1 hour all by yourself, right, especially when you cycle alone. And this is where you can do a lot of thinking while you're cycling, consider things. And, you know, you have 1 hour all by yourself to do things, which you don't have time. In a team sport, you probably don't have that chance at all. You know, in cycling, you can.
My next question, which is, what are the three principles that you want your children to continue to have in their life as a priority in their life?
I think since you want to know about children and kids and all that, right? You know, what makes you as a complete person or wise at any age of time, at any age, right? Is ability for you to understand the surrounding, what's happening now. But at the same time, you also so understand what has happened in the past, even when you were not around. I think this is where your kids has to really explore and learn, because, you know, people say this all the time. If you don't learn from history, you're going to repeat it again, right? And, you know, I'm 56 years old now. By the way, I'm the oldest in Gobi. I just found out about it. I'm even younger than, you know. So, you must understand history, because a lot of things is happening now, whether you like it or not, it's actually because of certain things that was caused by misunderstanding. People don't understand why things happened in the first place. If you understand the cause, what make that happen, then you can understand why this thing happened, and you know how to deal with it, right? So I think for young people, these are the things that they really need to know and learn history. You know, I think, you know, schools should make history as among the most important subjects. You know, like in our case here, history is not like, you know, you learn history, but it's not counted as the core, you know, you can just pass without, but no, I think history is very important.
And now we have the benefit of multiple sources as well, right? To learn.
Oh,
and
yes. Yeah.
To view the past interpretations. Well, I love that, JB. I mean, it's so powerful. Yeah. And that's actually something unique that's never been said before. But really understanding the past before you, because a lot of what you're living with is because of past decisions, right? And that's why really, you know, I love speaking to people, people who've been on the ground, who've done things, because this is where the lessons come through, right? Because again, you know, VC is not new. It's been around for years. Fund managers are not new. Investing is not new, but we're making some of the same mistakes because we didn't learn. Yeah. Well, JB, thank you so much. This is a wonderful way to end. And what a powerful message here for all of us. You know, we talked so much about innovation. We talked about purpose. We talked about luck, which is very important. And setting yourself up for that. That's a very important learning. And I so appreciate your time, your leadership, and everything that you've done for Malaysia and continue to do for Southeast Asia. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you to you too, for having me here as well. Let's do the most. You interview more people and we can learn from them as well. Yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
And thanks so much for tuning in this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow our socials on Sarah Chen Global to get the latest on the show. It would really help me out too if you enjoyed this to rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts and share your favorite episodes with a friend. I'm Sarah Chen Spellings and you've been listening to Billion Dollar Moves.